The seas are rising. And what does that mean for you, whether you live on the coasts or even far from them?
For most people, the biggest investment they're going to do in their lives or they're going to make in their lives is the house they're going to buy and the home they're going to build. And so I wanted to help them understand how, in different ways, climate is going to impact that, or they should at least be considering it so that they don't make a mistake without knowing it. The easiest example might be if you're on the coast and you're right on the water, then obviously rising seas are going to have an impact to the value of that house, your ability to resell it, your insurance premium going up. And all of us are indirectly impacted. If insurance premiums, even if they don't go up, then that means they're probably getting subsidized by taxpayers' dollars. And that means everyone's taxes are going up to cope with the rising costs.
That's Diogo Castrofreire. We talk with him about his film, Facing the Surge. It's the first in a series planned about the impact of climate change on you and me. Then the dangers to the workers who produce them of those everyday products made with cellulose, like rayon textiles and kitchen sponges. It's not the cellulose that's the problem, it's the carbon disulfide.
The most important early effects that was noted, even when it was first introduced in the 19th century in the rubber industry, is that it makes people crazy. Psychotic. They kill themselves. They become despondent. There's also a period of sexual excitation early on in exposure, which the French commentators love to talk about back in the 19th century, followed by impotence and loss of nerve sensation.
That's Paul Blank. We talk with him about his book, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. The Trump administration plans to get rid of environmental regulations. What does that mean in an era of climate change? What does that mean for workers facing poisons in the workplace? All that coming up today on Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. You can also hear us at PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.
Do you believe that it's been proven that CO2 is the primary control knob for climate? Do you believe that?
No, I think that measuring with precision human activity on the climate is something very challenging to do, and there's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. So no, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see.
That was Scott Pruitt, the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, talking on CNBC's Squawk Box on March 9th. Pruitt's uncertainty about the cause of global warming would be laughable if it weren't such a serious matter, given his plans to get rid of regulations that restrict climate-changing carbon pollution. New data shows that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere soared in 2016 at a record pace for the second year in a row. Other recent studies show sea level rise accelerating, worsening storm surges, and even causing sunny day flooding in many communities. That's what's happening to Norfolk, Virginia, on the front line, or shall we say, the shoreline of climate change. Norfolk is home to the largest naval base in the country, and to thousands of hardworking Americans struggling to adapt to the rising tides. My guest Diogo Castrofreire's film, Facing the Surge, takes the viewer to Norfolk, where he talks with residents, government officials, and scientists about the growing threat to their homes and community. The film also talks to folks around the country who are mobilizing to raise awareness and push our government to take action before it's too late. Before we talk with Diogo Freire, let's hear the trailer to his film, Facing the Surge.
Longtime residents might testify to the fact that water on the street probably only occurred during a big storm 50 years ago, but now is occurring several times a year with sunny day conditions. That is sea level rise.
It concerned me because, you know, one flood can be really devastating. And why would you have to wait to go through more than one flood to get help? That didn't make sense to me.
If you can put your house on stilts and you can afford the insurance, you're not the person investing in your roads or your sewer system or your infrastructure. That's a city decision and a municipal bond decision, and I think those decisions will change.
Things are so much worse than we ever could have predicted when we first started looking at this issue 30 years ago. I mean, the rate of change is just astounding.
When water starts rolling, you can't stop it. So you might as well face it.
Said, oh, so you're here lobbying Democrats. And I said, no, we're here lobbying everyone because this is, again, an issue that affects everyone. So the solution should be something that's worked on by everyone.
That was the trailer to Diogo Freire's film, Facing the Surge, the first in a series he's producing called Adaptation Now. And now to our interview with Freire. I spoke with him just prior to Trump taking office. Diogo Freire, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I am delighted to be here.
Let's start with your first film, Facing the Surge. How did you come to do this? You were not a filmmaker to begin with, is that right?
No, not at all. And I never really imagined that I would become a filmmaker. But I was very concerned about climate change. I used to work as a management consultant, and I thought that most of my career would be helping energy companies transition into a clean energy model. I think what happened, or I know what happened, was I began to realize that there wasn't the same sense of urgency in the companies I was working with. And that forced me to take a couple of steps back and realize that there was still a problem of public perception that needed to be addressed if we were going to get the speed which we need to move towards clean energy.
So we're not going to talk yet about the incoming administration, partly because it's just too depressing. But let's focus on the film, Facing the Surge. Now, the surge you're talking about is really the surge of sea level rise. But it's not just about storm surge. Let's say, you know, as the sea rises, obviously storm surges are also going to be higher and more dangerous. But you show that there is plenty of surge happening on sunny days, not just rainy days. So tell us, where do you go and what do you show in this film?
Yeah, it's the colloquial term, I think, is sunny day flooding. That's what's used. And it's very powerful, especially to see, because you realize, you know, there's no rain, there's no storm, but the streets can flood. And so what we're seeing on account of sea level rise, and in some areas of the country at an accelerated rate because there's subsidence at the same time, such as the case of Norfolk, is a greater number of times throughout the year where the streets flood on a sunny day. And when you add a storm surge to that, it just gets more dangerous. And so people in neighborhoods where they've lived for a long time are now having to raise their houses. The city government is having to pay to raise the streets. And all these costs are adding up and forcing people to face difficult questions about, you know, how can I afford this? Am I going to be able to stay here? And it's happening in some areas in a more pronounced way, but it's really a story that's universal for all coastal communities.
When you look at some specific coastal communities, right off the bat, you go to Norfolk, Virginia. Talk about the Virginia coast and its vulnerability.
So Norfolk is a very important case study, and it is one town where what's happening is happening in an accelerated form. And the reason for that is since 1930 to 2016, the average rate of sea level rise for the east coast of the United States was about 7 inches. In Norfolk, 8 inches, sorry. In Norfolk, it was double that. It was 16. And that's because the land there is also sinking at the same time. And so they get an advanced look at all the issues that coastal towns are going to face. That's one of the reasons why we picked Norfolk to begin with. The other reason was we thought it would be a good opportunity to introduce a new perspective that most people aren't really familiar with, which was the military perspective. Norfolk is also home to the largest naval base in the United States, quite possibly the world. And Norfolk Naval Station is, as you would imagine, right on the water. And so they face a lot of the same issues the community is facing. They're having to raise their piers, which have been put in place since World War II and are now affected by the higher waters. And they have issues that they can't solve by themselves because 90% of the staff of the base lives off the base. And so even if they can prepare the base and do all the necessary investments inside the base, they don't have authority over the streets. That's a city issue. And if the streets aren't being raised and there's high waters and there's flooding and people can't get into or out of the base, you're compromising mission readiness, so to speak. So you have all these different manifestations that people probably don't think about when they're thinking about sea level rise as an abstract concept. But once you start experiencing and living it as the people of Norfolk do, then you start to see how complicated it gets.
And tell us about some of those people you spoke with in Norfolk. I mean, it just must be a terribly frightening thing to have a home that is flooding on a repeated basis, or to go out onto your street on a sunny day and have to wade through a few inches of water.
Yes, it is frightening. And I think it is frightening as well, because I think it's important to state that they're frightened on many levels. There is the level of just having to face and experience flooding. There is the level of, let's call it, financial security. Can I afford an increase in flood insurance? Can I afford to pay for the damages that result from flooding? There is a notion that some people have that it's maybe not safe to talk about the underlying issues. Can I say the words climate change, or is that going to create tension in my community, in my tribe, so to speak? So there are all these different emotions and concerns that the town has to grapple with at the same time.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author and filmmaker Diogo Freire about his film Facing the Surge. It's the first in a series of films about climate change called Adaptation Now. It's also accompanied by a book, When Climate Change Hits Home. And one of the people in your film actually said that because the fossil fuel industries dominate the Virginia General Assembly, you're not allowed to talk about climate change, I assume, in the assembly. You're not allowed to use those words. Give us the context.
Mm-hmm. And this doesn't seem to be only particular to Virginia. There have been reports of this happening in North Carolina. There's certainly been reports of this happening in Florida, where the words become somewhat taboo and public officials are even if not directly told, then they certainly feel that they should avoid saying it so that it doesn't bring them unnecessary trouble. And I think that's just an unfortunate manifestation of the fact that it's become a politicized issue for the last 10 years in the U.S. And hopefully we'll move away from that, but I'm not sure that's going to happen as fast as we want it to. And part of what we're, doing, or that I'm doing with this film and with this book, is introduce the topic from different lenses, introduce new messengers, try to bring the stories that are going to help us expand the group of people that worry about this issue beyond the traditional environmental movement. So the military perspective, I think, is an important one. But there are so many other communities that are affected by climate change. Agriculture is another. So topics that are going to be relevant to rural communities in the U.S. And I think it's really important for us to present those stories so that we can start to help people understand that this isn't a political issue and that it's very relevant to you no matter what your political stripes are.
I think a lot of people, I think that this is something that's going to happen far into the future. You point out in some coastal communities it's happening right now. Give us a sense of, what kind of sea level rise we are expecting at this point, because there's a caveat there. it seems that the predictions always seem to get worse the more the scientists know. But what's the current state?
Yeah, so I for that very same reason, try to avoid giving a specific estimate because I think the numbers keep going up. And so what I think most towns need to understand is that, in my opinion, at this point, it is very unlikely that they will look the same way they do today by the end of this century, and that those changes may come faster. And so on the one hand, we need to continue to work on mitigation to prevent the worst case scenarios from happening. But on the other hand, every coastal town at this point should be preparing, should have a resilience plan in place and should be preparing to build defenses, retreat some areas, and have some sort of framework they can use so that these impacts are dealt with in an orderly way and aren't as disruptive as they would be otherwise. But you are going to get more feet of sea level rise this century.
Yeah, and so this is a problem that's going to impact people, as you say, of all political stripes. It does seem that people who are conservatives or see themselves as conservatives almost have a cultural antipathy to the notion of climate change. How do you feel your film, your book, and, you know, we in general who are freaking out about this problem, how can we reach out to people who don't want to hear anything about it?
And I think I think that's a great question. And one of the ways that I look at it, and it's partly informed by the research that went into these two projects, looking at the work of things like the Yale Climate Change Communication Program that tries to analyze, to some extent, the social psychology of what's happening. I think there's some important takeaways to keep in mind. And one is we don't need to convince everybody, right? We need a strong majority on these issues, but it's impossible to think that everyone is going to be convinced of this. And that's an impossible ordeal and not necessary. The other one is the majority of people is probably somewhat concerned, but it's still an abstract concept for them. So for them, it's really about connecting those dots and helping them see the relevance of how climate change will personally impact them. So it's not that abstract of a concept. So focusing on the stories of towns like Norfolk that are experiencing sea level rise, of winter sport communities that are facing the prospect of shutting down because they don't have enough of a season anymore. So things that are very tangible and that people can quickly understand the relationship to a warming climate. And then the third thing that I'm a little bit hopeful about is that we are starting to see, let's call it, more leadership coming from within, let's call it, moderate and conservative sectors of society, which certainly was lacking in the last decade, but we're starting to see that some of that reemerge with figures such as Bob Inglis, Hank Paulson, former Secretary of the Treasury. Arnold Schwarzenegger has always been outspoken on this, but people who would associate themselves with the Republican Party and are now outspoken and saying, we care about climate change, this is an issue we should be paying attention to. And I think that will have influence. And I think the most prominent examples of that that are also recent are the members of Congress that have signed the Gibson Resolution, that have joined the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus, where you're not allowed to join unless you come in with a pair. It's always in pairs, so you have to join. One member has to be a Republican, one member has to be a Democrat for them to be able to join. And all these things are new initiatives that kind of happened last year. And they give me hope that we will eventually make this a bipartisan issue, or that there at least will be enough people on both sides of the aisle caring about this to get meaningful measures passed. Now, will it happen in time? You know, we got to stay hopeful and believe that it can happen in time.
The Gibson Resolution, what is that?
The Gibson Resolution was, to summarize, was basically a resolution acknowledging that climate change is real and man-made and that there is a need to act on it. And so it was really a statement of, we acknowledge these facts to be true. And I think that's an important step because beforehand, I think that the party line was somewhat of a one of dismissing the reality of this.
You titled the series Adaptation. I was a little curious about that because adaptation is a strategy of adapting to climate change, and then people contrast that with mitigation, which is actually, you know, decreasing the carbon emissions that lead to climate change. So I wonder if you weigh in a little bit on adaptation and mitigation and why you chose the term adaptation.
Yeah, I think you've defined it well. Usually adaptation is thought of just adapting to the new reality of climate, and then mitigation is taking steps to prevent that new reality from coming to be. I called it adaptation now, not in that sense, but because I wanted to show how people, whether they wanted to or not, are being forced to adapt to climate change, and that it's happening today already. So again, it was part of this goal of making this not an abstract, long-term issue, but helping people see this is already happening today, and it's happening to people that you may not have thought of, but are actually probably connected to you. You will be able to think of someone you know living on a coastal community if you're not living in a coastal community yourself. Or as we start to add in the different pieces of the puzzle, you get to see this broader perspective of how it's impacting so many different communities. The migration of Lyme disease into Maine because the temperatures are warmer, the greater number of extremely hot days and what that does to hospital admissions throughout the entire south of the United States. Drought conditions exacerbated in California, forcing farmers to give up their land. So there is no, sadly, shortage of examples of how people are being forced to adapt to climate change today. And that's why we decided to go with the name Adaptation Now.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with author and filmmaker Diogo Freire about his film Facing the Surge. It's the first in a series of films about climate change called Adaptation Now, and it's accompanied by a book, When Climate Change Hits Home. So one of the groups that's working on trying to combat climate change itself on the mitigation side of it is one that you highlight in this movie, Facing the Surge. It's the Citizens Climate Lobby. Tell us about that lobby and why you decided to follow them.
Yes. So first of all, I think they're doing phenomenal work. And that was part of the reason why I very much wanted to include them in the film. And it was a little bit by luck that we crossed paths. I majored in economics in college. And so when I was designing the series to begin with, I wanted to be very focused and sequential in how we presented solutions. I didn't want any of the movies to just be doom and gloom. I wanted people to get access to solutions that they could participate in and realize that they had a bigger role to play and inspire them to take that role. And in the first film, it was very important for me to start with a carbon price. So I strongly believe that the first step that would have the greatest impact in terms of helping us move to a clean energy economy and address climate change would be a strong price on the sources of carbon pollution. And so I was looking for that, and honestly, I was going to give up because I couldn't find a way of telling that story that I thought would be meaningful or resonate with a large audience without making it a lecture. And I was at a rally in Oakland that was the sister rally of the People's Climate March back in 2014. And there was a volunteer from Citizens Climate Lobby handing out flyers among, you know, many volunteers from many organizations that came together that day. And I grabbed his flyer. His name was Harold Hedelman. And I heard him say, you know, we're citizens advocating for a price on carbon. And I had to stop and take a couple of steps back and just start talking to him because that was what I was looking for. And as I got to know the organization, I completely fell in love with it, not just because I found that the policy that they were advocating for was sound, but incredibly deep and detailed and well thought out. But their approach was beautiful. I mean, they were basically, and they are, empowering anyone who wants to act on this issue to be an effective spokesperson and advocate and to interact in an effective way directly with their elected representatives. and they're giving them the necessary tools and coaching and support groups. And so this growing community of now thousands of people, you know, throughout the year is putting pressure on members of Congress to pass meaningful legislation, in this case, a price on carbon. And so I fell in love with that, and I just had to include that in the film. And I'm very glad that I did.
So where can people see this film? And what are the films that you plan to continue with in this series?
So people can go to the website, adaptationnow.com, or they can just Google Facing the Surge and it will come up. And they'll be able to watch the film on Vimeo or order a DVD. And in terms of future projects, the next one is most likely going to be focused on what's happening with winter sports. And how is the winter sports community responding to the prospect of a shorter winter? And and really examine what does that mean for those communities if fewer people are going to come up and practice? And what does that mean for the economy and vitality and well-being of those communities?
Now, you also have a book, When Climate Change Hits Home. I'm looking at a list of the chapters. Very interesting. You include the basics of climate change, and then you talk about people and property at risk. Talk about some of the ways in which the risk to property, I mean, the obvious one is of sea level rise, but we don't often think about things like insurance, and that's something you also talk about in the movie Facing the Surge. So tell us a little bit about that.
So in the book, again, I wanted to make climate change very real and relevant to what people worry about and what people think about. And I think for most people, the biggest investment they're going to do in their lives or they're going to make in their lives is the house they're going to buy and the home they're going to build. And so I wanted to help them understand how in different ways climate is going to impact that, or they should at least be considering it so that they don't make a mistake without knowing it. And I think the easiest example might be if you're on the coast and you're right on the water, then obviously rising seas are going to have an impact to the value of that house, your ability to resell it, your insurance premium going up, which was what you were asking about. And we're starting to see that. And you know, all of us are indirectly impacted. If insurance premiums, even if they don't go up, then that means they're probably getting subsidized by taxpayers' dollars. And that means everyone's taxes are going up to cope with the rising costs, right? But even if we go outside of that, you may be buying a house in the mountains. And how have conditions changed there? Is it getting drier? If so, is there a greater risk of wildfire? If there's a greater risk of wildfire, what does that mean for your house? Is it properly, have you taken the necessary measures to protect it? Has the community in which you're embedded in also taken measures at their level? Because there's stuff you can do and you may be aware of it, but if your broader community is not acting on it, then there are things that are kind of outside of your scope of influence, right? You may be able to raise your house, but if no one's planning to raise the street, how are you going to get to and from the house? If people aren't looking at sewage infrastructure or electricity infrastructure, you know, are you going to get power? Are you going to have issues with sewage? So all of these things are happening, and I think there's a wide spectrum of how active different communities are at it or proactively addressing this. And so I wanted to bring this up to people so that when they think about climate, they start including it in their decisions and they start bringing it to the attention of their elected officials, even on a local level.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I mean, we can point to the example of Vermont, Hurricane Irene. I mean, Vermont is experiencing far more. I believe that the Northeast has already experienced or is expected to experience a 71% increase in torrential downpours. And Hurricane Irene hit Vermont and many communities were taken out. And these were, you know, roads were taken out, homes were taken out. These are mountain communities far from the ocean. But there are some pretty clear indications that the severity of hurricanes like Irene are very much driven by climate change.
Oh, absolutely. And another one that I often point out that I think people tend not to think about as much, but it's just heat. When you get extremely hot days, you have spikes in hospital admissions because all sorts of health conditions get exacerbated. And so, and it's usually, you know, the youngest and the oldest in the population that are most vulnerable to this, but we are going to see higher numbers of extremely hot days, particularly in the South. So one of the things that I recommend to people after we do screenings of Facing the Surge that I attend is to just go explore the National Climate Assessment. Google that and go on change.gov and explore the findings where they look at region by region of the U.S. and kind of identify what are the key trends that they can you can see today and how they're going to evolve over time. And that way, I think people can start to understand the many different manifestations of climate change and how they may be more and which ones are more relevant to the areas they live in.
And we will link to that on our website, the National Climate Assessment. So just in the minute or two that we have left, you know, I think a lot of people are feeling pretty, you know, a certain amount of despair. As you pointed out, you know, we don't have a lot of time left. We may not even have any time left to avert catastrophic climate change. And we have an incoming administration that is just packed full with climate change deniers and fossil fuel interests. What do you think people can do now to really help help us continue on track with combating climate change and adapting to it?
I absolutely think we need to raise the priority of climate in public discourse. And we saw even before the result of the election, it wasn't really talked about that often during the debates. It wasn't brought up as a question during the main debates. And so that means we need to get more people saying it matters to them. And so I think people just honestly need to bring it up more often in their daily lives. And part of the reason why I like or decided to focus on making films was it can be really hard sometimes for you to start a conversation about climate change. And I used to joke at the screenings and say, you know, if you invite people over to your house on a Wednesday afternoon to talk about climate, you'll be surprised to find that everyone's going to be busy. But if you say, come over to my house, we're going to watch a short documentary, people are more relaxed. It's a social event. And then they've had this shared experience that puts them on an almost equal footing that allows them to have a productive conversation about these issues. And so I really hope people use mechanisms like this or engagement tools like this to make sure that everyone in their network, whether it's family or friends or neighbors, is talking about this. And I think a lot of people want to. They just don't want to take the first step. So we need some people to do that. The other thing is absolutely go join groups like Citizens Climate Lobby, because the more coordinated these voices are, the more impact they're going to have. And if we have a new administration coming in that's nominated or that includes a lot of historically high-profile opponents to climate action, then I think we need to put most of our pressure on the moderates in Congress that are not going to ensure that they don't allow anything too disruptive or destructive, is the right term here, to pass. And so groups like Citizens Climate Lobby that are focused on that are incredibly important. And then there are just other groups that are doing local action, like the Ready for 100% by the Sierra Club, which is bypassing federal action altogether and saying we can get our mayors and our city councils to just adopt renewable energy straight away. Those are other ways of ensuring that there is still progress happening. But I really hope people add their voice to those groups and join it, not just because it'll give them focus and support, but it'll also give them, you know, access to best practices so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel or make mistakes that others have already made on this journey.
So finally, Diogo Castro Freire, you are a young man. You have most of your life ahead of you. What are your personal feelings as you wake up every day and you're working with this issue of climate change in your work? And when you think about having a family, having children, I don't know if you already do or not, you know, living in a place like Washington, D.C., what gets you in your gut about this?
You know, my emotions alternate between being scared sometimes and being hopeful and optimistic at others. And I think it's impossible. It would be, there's no way of living with this or working on this and not feeling that way. I was reading the other day a statement that I thought was very to the point, which was, if you're not somewhat depressed by this, then you're probably looking at the wrong set of data. But if you're not hopeful and encouraged by the thousands, probably now millions of people who are volunteering to work on this in their own time, then you don't have a heart. And so my state of mind really alternates between those two. I definitely prefer the latter, but sometimes the former happens inevitably as I, you know, read the latest report. So to me, this is not even an environmental issue. This is about you know, humanity. How do we ensure millions of people, billions of people over the next, in the future, and certainly in my lifetime, are not going to, and already today, are not going to, you know, suffer unnecessarily or have a premature death on account of a changing climate. And so I can't think of anything else to work on, and I feel somewhat compelled to do this. Maybe that's the right word. This is all about feeling compelled to do this because it's such a colossal challenge that we have an opportunity to address.
Well, we are so glad that you are doing this. Diogo Castrofreire, your film is Adaptation Facing the Surge. Your book is When Climate Change Hits Home. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
Diogo Freire. I spoke with him not long before Donald Trump took office. Facing the Surge is available to stream or download. Find the link at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Paul Blank about his new book, Fake Silk. It's about the lethal history of viscose rayon. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. While Scott Pruitt is planning to do away with environmental regulations that keep our air and water clean, what's likely to happen to regulations that protect workers? Given that Trump wants to take a wrecking ball to the entire regulatory framework of the U.S. government, the signs are ominous. But it's not as if worker protections have been all that robust under previous administrations. I spent years working as an advocate and trainer for worker health and safety, and except for the laudable example of Clinton's first labor secretary, Robert Reich, OSHA, which is in the Department of Labor, has been a pretty toothless agency since deregulator-in-chief Ronald Reagan came into office. My guest, Paul Blank, is professor of occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California. We spoke to him last in 2008 about his book, How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. Now he's out with a new book for the general public about the poisonous process behind the manufacture of that silky smooth fabric, rayon, and many other common household products. It's called Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. The book tells a dark story of hazardous manufacturing, poisonous materials, environmental abuses, political machinations, and economics trumping safety concerns. Blank investigates the history of the rayon industry's practices from the beginning through two highly profitable world wars, the mid-century export of hazardous manufacturing to developing countries, and the current greenwashing of viscose as an eco-friendly product. We spoke with him in the fall. Well, Paul Blank, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
There are not a lot of books like Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon, and that's because the whole field of occupational health, I know because I was part of it for more than two decades, is like a little backwater, a little niche. And it always seemed to me that this was such a bizarre thing because, after all, at one time at least, most American workers worked in factories. Many environmental toxins that are poisoning our neighborhoods have their origin in factories, in manufacturing plants. I wonder if you could just weigh in a little bit on as to why do you think occupational health is the kind of thing that makes people's eyes glaze over when you say you're in it?
Well, actually, I wouldn't say that their eyes glaze over. What they say is either what is that, or that's occupational therapy, isn't it?
Right.
Or do we still need that? But mostly, people don't actually know that there's a discipline that addresses the health of workers.
And that it just seems like that's a very bizarre thing, because after all, most of us are workers, and even people who don't work in manufacturing have plenty of exposures to environmental toxins, nurses and even office workers.
Well, and agricultural workers and all kinds of construction workers that are not factory workers. And, of course, there are lots of avocational exposures that are serious as well and are kind of a gray zone. And then if you consider work around the house, unsalaried work, mostly done by women, that's also occupational health. And in certain places, the exposures are considerable there, especially now that exposure to biomass fuel smoke, for example, in much of the world.
Yeah, and actually you've written about household hazards.
Yes, I do, but I like to connect it to the workplace as well.
Exactly. And today we're going to be doing that, actually, because this is a fascinating story, Fake Silk. It's a story of viscose rayon. Rayon is, you know, probably one of the most common artificial or man-made fibers. You say the story of viscose manufacturing and the disease it has caused and causes, by rights, should not be obscure. It deserves to be every bit as familiar as the cautionary tales of asbestos insulation, leaded paint, or the mercury-tainted seafood in Minamata Bay. So why has the story of viscose, why hasn't that been better known?
Well, first of all, I think no one's really shined a very bright light on it. And that's one of the goals of this book, is to do just that. A second thing is that when a product isn't particularly hazardous to the consumers themselves, people tend to lose interest a bit. So when you think about asbestos, which has horrible effects among working populations, but has not been a trivial issue for people downstream, that catches people's attention, just as one example. And lead poisoning, of course, also, which is both environmental and occupational. So I think there's different aspects to it. I think there's also been an aspect over the history of illness in this industry of the industry itself being a powerful lobby against control from regulators, but also really against getting the word out at all, which is, of course, not unique to this industry. But at one time, it was a very powerful one.
So how is rayon made, and why is the process toxic?
So rayon is a cellulose-based product, and I like to use the word viscose because that describes the process in question and also gets at some of the other products aside from textiles that are made exactly the same way. What it is a process by which cellulose, which can come from wood pulp or from other sources, is ground up, and that in and of itself is not a particular problem. But it's mixed in the process with a very toxic and unusual chemical called carbon disulfide. And really, carbon disulfide is at the heart of the problems in this process. It's mixed together. It forms a kind of syrupy yellow liquid, a kind of toxic maple syrup, if you will. And then it's forced down pipes and extruded through little spinnerets with little tiny holes that spin out the liquid in a bath of sulfuric acid. And as this liquid hits the acid, the carbon disulfide leaves the liquid and the liquid coagulates into threads if you're making rayon fiber. But if you extrude it instead of in little holes, if you extrude it through long sheets, you make a film, which most everybody knows by another name, which is cellophane.
And so carbon disulfide, that's the real source of it. What are some of the toxic effects of carbon disulfide?
Well, its effects are protean, but one of the most important early effects that was noted, even when it was first introduced in the 19th century in the rubber industry, is that it makes people crazy, psychotic. They kill themselves. They become despondent. There's also a period of sexual excitation early on in exposure, which the French commentators loved to talk about back in the 19th century, followed by impotence and loss of nerve sensation. So that's in the high-level exposure. But with longer exposure, there are other neurologic effects, including Parkinsonism, which wasn't recognized until the 1930s. And then with even longer, lower-level exposure, a predilection to early-age heart attack and stroke.
Well, those are pretty serious. So you write in this book, Paul Blanc, you write in Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon, that you want to name names, that you want to give the victims a face. Of course, so often that's exactly what's lost when it comes to worker health. Tell us a story about one of the workers that you write about in the book.
Well, some of them we have names. Some of them we only have initials. Some of them we know more than that from governmental reports. But this industry, which in the 1930s was huge and was a very important part of the war industries, both for the Axis and for the Allies, but particularly for the Axis. There was a factory in Italy where the fascist regime sent in labor spies to work in the factory so that they could detect worker agitation against the government. And the spies that they sent in, all they would do is write back not about suspect coworkers, but about the horrible working conditions, that somebody needed to do something. And one of the workers they described was burned in an explosion because carbon disulfide, aside from everything else, is also quite flammable. And on fire, he jumped into the nearest vat of liquid that he could to put out the flames, but it was a vat of sulfuric acid. There's a woman named Agnes Humbert, who was a prisoner and slave laborer under the Germans. She was a French resistance fighter who was arrested early in the German occupation. She was sent to a factory in Germany that manufactured rayon textiles and employed slave labor. And right after the war, she wrote down her experiences as a diary written after the fact and described the terrible effects as well, even though she had no idea of the chemical nature of carbon disulfide and never uses that word in her memoir.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Paul Blanc about his book, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. Blanc teaches environmental and occupational medicine at the University of California. So one of the reactions you've gotten when you've talked and when you've told people that you've written this book is they say, rayon, are we still using it? Talk about how rayon is being used and produced today.
Well, rayon is very much with us, but people will maybe only know it as viscose because when they buy a sweater, it's a viscose blend. They have no idea that viscose is rayon, and that's in part because rayon is, over time, at various times, taken on tawdry or cheap connotations, and so viscose is not tainted in the same way. The viscose rayon fibers are, by and large, produced mainly outside of Europe and North America, the old sites of manufacture. So now the big players are India and China and Indonesia, with a little bit of residual production still in Europe
and
other places.
Well, the conditions in factories in India and China are not known for being particularly careful of worker health and safety.
No, and probably India is, if anything, worse than China. And there are some medical reports out of China, but I've not been able to identify very much at all out of India, just a few reports here and there. That the largest description I saw was not of a from a biomedical journal, but an anthropological report on a factory town in India, where unfortunately I think the anthropologist didn't have much grasp of the toxicology he was describing, because he emphasized that the impotence that was rampant among the workforce was a symbolic response to religious cultural suspicion of factories.
Oh my God!
It's a very odd piece. In terms of non-textile viscose, it's still very much with us, even in North America. We have one of the largest cellophane factories in the world, and viscose sponges, which almost everybody has on their kitchen counter, are made right here in America and in Sweden and in France. And also another very big industry, as it turns out, is viscose casings for skinless weenies and sausages.
And people are eating them? No.
No. What you do is you make it into, and then you peel it away, and then you have a skinless sausage.
Oh, that's
instead of using intestine, right, which you could eat.
Now, what about regulatory oversight and OSHA? I mean, is there any kind of, you know, are there any standards that apply to the manufacture of viscose rayon and exposures to carbon disulfide?
Yes, there have been standards for carbon disulfide for decades. Unfortunately, the standards haven't changed in decades either. So the U.S. OSHA standard of 20 parts per million, for example, is one of the least protective in the world. I think India has the same level, but almost everywhere else, not just in Europe, but even China has a more protective level, at least on paper. The OSHA tried to correct this about 20 years ago in a group of standards they tried to change. They were taken to the Supreme Court and they lost for poor reasons and have never gone back to it. For example, California, which has the power to make its own OSHA standards, its level is one part per million, 20 times more restrictive.
Wow. And I assume that under a Trump administration, those standards are not going to be getting any stricter on the national level.
I think that is a safe prediction.
Now, you say that...
And maybe he'll be able to bring back toxic rayon textile factories to the places where they last were. Alabama was our last big toxic rayon manufacturing site.
And is there also exposure to the surrounding community?
Yes, there is a significant release of carbon disulfide from manufacturing sites. They just send it up the chimneys. Usually it passes the workers' faces first, but yes.
So it would have impacts on, you know, children and adults living in the area.
It could. There was a famous suit in around that plant in Alabama by some rural-dwelling folks whose horses died, and this was attributed to carbon disulfide ambient release.
Now, your book, Fake Silk, talks about the current greenwashing of viscose as an eco-friendly product. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I describe it as sort of the ultimate corporate chutzpah, because basically they say, well, you know, it's cellulose. It's 100% cellulose, which is a renewable resource, so it's a green product. Well, they conveniently, you know, forget that it was made with carbon disulfide as well. And even though the carbon disulfide is not in the final product, that's only because it went out into the workroom air. Somehow that makes it green.
And there's even a new brand of cellophane called Nature Flex.
Uh-huh. That wouldn't surprise me.
It sounds so ecological.
Yes. And I grant you, they're not petroleum-based in that sense, although carbon disulfide didn't come out of thin air. It's made from coal. So, in fact, carbon disulfide is a non-renewable resource from that point of view.
And so dependent on the the fossil fuel industry to some degree.
Yes.
Although coal is going away, what are they going to do about getting carbon disulfide when the coal industry goes bust?
I don't think coal is going that away. And you can make it from natural gas, by the way, also, I should say.
Uh-huh. Another
modern methods, probably most of the carbon disulfide, in fact, is not made from coal, but from natural gas.
And also carbon disulfide, was it used in fracking? I thought I saw a reference.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
And cool. I mean, it's a great solvent.
Yeah.
And I have not seen that application. That would be quite scary.
Hmm. Well, your book is Fake Silk, Dr. Paul Blanc. It is a great read. It's The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. And thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, a pleasure.
Paul Blanc, Fake Silk is published by Yale University Press. Here's a poem published in the anthology Poetry Daily, 366 poems from the world's most popular poetry website. The Accomplice by David Clewell. This poem isn't an intricate theory years in the making. This poem can speak only for this poem. This poem will tell you it's not what you think. This poem is nothing more than a series of coincidences. This poem can't help but attract the occasional crackpot. This poem is offered in full compliance with the Freedom of Information Act. This poem is not anything like the official version. This poem is holding something back. This poem is covering up. This poem may be afraid of worldwide panic. This poem is no secret prototype the government is testing. This poem has a lot of powerful friends behind it. This poem is something you'd be happier not knowing. This poem is murder on reliable witnesses. This poem is counting on your complete cooperation. This poem can put you at the scene of untold crimes, or this poem is your ironclad alibi, depending. This poem doesn't want anything to happen to you. This poem hopes you get the message, although this poem has no explicit message of its own. This poem can't promise it will bail you out. This poem won't even remember you. This poem is well aware of the statute of limitations. This poem means what it says. This poem means anything you need it to. This poem has seen things hard to believe. This poem is all you have to believe. This poem has implications. This poem couldn't possibly be. This poem is so good, it ought to be illegal. This poem is the only hard evidence recovered. This poem has your prints all over it. This poem has recently been discharged. This poem is not a disgruntled loner acting spontaneously. This poem has been seen consorting with other known poems. This poem has Confederates in top floor windows all over the city. This poem never goes by the same name twice. This poem has no highly trained Russian lookalike. This poem never received specific instructions. This poem has nothing better to do. This poem can hit you where you live. This poem seldom misses at this distance. The Accomplice by David Clewell. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.